Are Kansas's strict voter registration laws necessary protections against fraud, or are they a nakedly political attempt to disenfranchise certain voters? That question is at the heart of a trial going on at the federal courthouse in Kansas City, Kansas. Kansas's flamboyant Secretary of State Chris Kobach is on one side, the American Civil Liberties Union the other. We'll talk about that after we check in on the latest from the Statehouse. I'm Jim McLean, and this is Statehouse Blend, Kansas. Joining us is Stephen Caranda, Kansas Public Radio's Statehouse Bureau Chief. So with you, Stephen, let's get right to what's been going on at the Statehouse. No action on school finance, but we know that's coming. But the House did vote this week on a bill that would restore due process for Kansas teachers. Tell me what that's about.
So if anyone remembers, in 2014, they eliminated a state requirement for these due process protections. And what it means is a teacher who's going to be fired or their contract not renewed, they're entitled to, if they want it, a hearing before an impartial person who would basically hear both sides and decide if the dismissal is justified or not. Some districts still have it because teachers have negotiated it into their contracts, but it's not everywhere, and this would put it back in state law.
And this was something that a lot of teachers or a lot of education advocates referred to as the teacher tenure battle, right?
Well, they would say due process and might not like if you call it tenure, but some people call it tenure. They call it due process.
So I have that in reverse, but it has been a very big symbolic battle, has it not?
Yeah, that's been what a lot of people have said. They've argued that teachers are not respected, and getting rid of this makes it harder to recruit teachers. Republican Representative Mary Martha Good put it this way during the House debate.
This process has worked effectively for many years. Our teachers need to feel supported and protected.
Okay, Stephen, I know you were on the House floor, but there was another side to that debate. There were people who were opposed to putting this back in state law, right?
People who did not like this bill say it should be up to local districts. The state shouldn't be requiring it. Here's John Whitmer, another Republican.
My objection really to the underlying bill is that we're mandating from the state instead of allowing local control.
Beyond that, there was some discussion in the State House this week, and this can get pretty dry pretty quickly, but it's also very important because it has to do with, there are a lot of economic development programs that the state has in place where they forgive taxes and they give tax breaks and they use...
Or in the case of star bonds, divert money that would otherwise go to the state to pay back bonds.
Yeah, you're hustling me to the point that I wanted to make. I mean, there was quite a bit of debate about star bonds recently. Explain what star bonds are.
So the way this works is local governments, if they get approval from the Secretary of Commerce, they can issue these bonds for building projects, and then you create this star bond district, and tax revenue that would normally be collected by the local governments and the state, sales tax, is instead diverted to pay back the bonds.
Okay. All right.
And so the idea is it's a way to boost economic growth, projects that otherwise might not happen.
Right. And we know that star bonds were used to build the Legendary over in KCK and
the Speedway
and all that.
But then a bunch of other projects people might not know about.
Right. And I think that's what's leading. I know Senator Jim Denning, who's the Senate Majority Leader, has some concern that this program is kind of getting out of control. At the committee hearings and so forth that you attended, is that what's at the heart of this as to whether or not we're being picky enough in terms of what we say qualifies as a star bond district and what doesn't?
That's exactly right. In fact, both Democrats and Republicans have some concerns. And we also heard just from some local government officials and regular citizens. There was one gentleman who was there. His name's Clint Anderson. He lives in Johnson County. He's a financial advisor. And he came to say, look, if projects make sense, the state doesn't need to use a program like this to build them.
If there's a good idea that's operationally and economically feasible, there's capital for it. It shouldn't be paid for by the taxpayers.
So his argument is the private market should be funding these kind of things. But we also heard from local government officials saying there are just some projects that need a boost like this to get off the ground.
What is this story that you did this week about, and I'm not even sure what to call them, Stephen, but there's a story about these poor your own pubs. And how did that get on the legislative agenda?
Well, this is something that exists in other areas. There's one on the Missouri side of Kansas City. There's also one in St. Louis. And they're these bars where they generally focus on local beers. You go in, it's a pretty high-tech operation. You get an electronic card, you put a certain amount of money on it, or there are limits on the card. And then you can go to all these different taps and use your card to dispense a little bit of beer to yourself. And it's a way to try all these different beers in kind of this different kind of atmosphere. That's the way Ryan Kavanaugh described it to me. He's been working on a project called Brew Bank, planned for downtown Topeka.
I think for the patrons to be able to try all of these beers and try them responsibly in small amounts is just an exciting thing. And let's face it, the technology is just really cool.
There's a backstory here, isn't there, with this Kavanaugh guy? Because I've been reading in the paper that there's been this big competition, people with entrepreneurial ideas, and they've had this competition as to who then is going to get a certain amount of money to help get these ideas off the ground. And wasn't this guy one of the winners?
He was. Him and some of his partners had this brew bank idea, and they came out on top in the contest, $100,000 investment. Then they found out it's not legal in Kansas. A little
really?
Bit of a problem there. So now they're going to the legislature and saying, hey, make this legal because we already allow pour-it-yourself wine taps, although there aren't currently any in use in the state.
But they're legal.
Correct. So they're saying, look, we already allow this. Let's just tweak it a little bit so you can pour your own beer.
As usual, you've done a fine job of bringing us up to date on some of these important issues. And, you know, we're churning to the really productive time in the session when they're going to really be tackling the big stuff. And we look forward to having you here to explain all that, too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our good friend and Kansas News Service reporter Shioya Yopis Jepson has spent the last several working days in that federal courtroom in KCK. She's covering the high-stakes trial concerning Kansas's voter laws, laws that the ACLU says have kept roughly 30,000 legal citizens from voting. There's been a lot of drama in the courtroom, and we'll get to that in a bit. But first, some background on the case from Celia.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go back very quickly to 2013.
Okay.
At that point, Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach is, of course, in office. And as you know, he had lobbied for and gotten the legislature to pass a law that meant that starting in 2013, anyone who wanted to register to vote in Kansas had to show documentary proof of citizenship. So that would be, for example, getting out your birth certificate, your passport, your naturalization papers, something like that that proves in writing that you're a U.S. citizen. And that's actually very unusual nationally. There are only two states that are actually implementing a law like that. The other one is Arizona. But according to the ACLU, Kansas's is by far the strictest because effectively in Arizona, you can use your driver's license number to register to vote. But in Kansas, that's not enough. So Kansas is the focus of this litigation. And what it's really about is that when Kansas put that
requirement
mm-hmm. into effect, it blocked, according to the ACLU's experts who have analyzed Kansas's voter rolls repeatedly, upwards of 30,000 people from registering to vote. I mean, they had filled out the forms to register, but the registration was ultimately blocked and in many cases canceled because they did not have the documented proof of citizenship.
And so the ACLU, of course, is the American Civil Liberties Union.
Right. They see this law as voter suppression. I spoke to a nationally known professor ahead of this trial, Rick Hassan, who is a law professor and political science professor in California at UC Irvine. And he said that there's a kind of politics of election law. There's red state law, blue state law, as he described it. You know, from that point of view, from that theory, is mm-hmm. an excellent example of red state law, where more restrictive voter registration requirements theoretically benefit Republicans, and making it easier to register to vote theoretically at the polls benefits Democrats.
And so Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State in Kansas, who we should mention at some point is also running for the Republican nomination for governor, his argument would be that he imposed these new requirements, these registration requirements, because he wanted to stop voter fraud. Specifically, he wanted to make sure that non-citizens were not voting. I mean, that's what he's arguing, correct?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, so the ACLU is making the case that there's not evidence of the type of fraud that he's talking about. And what we heard on Friday was a professor from Rutgers, Professor Lorraine Menitti. She has studied voter fraud for a long time and also the politics of voter fraud. Nationally, she's found that usually allegations are false. They don't turn out to be what they appear to be. Now, in Kansas, that seems to be the same thing. And what's really interesting, Jim, is that looking back at about 20 Kansas newspapers going back to the 90s, she found there really wasn't much public concern, interest, conversation, news reports about voter fraud until Kris Kobach ran for Secretary of State in 2010. on the campaign trail, he repeatedly made assertions that he wanted to put a stop to voter fraud, which of course is predicated on the idea that there is a widespread
voter fraud. Yeah, he would make the case that voter fraud, whether we knew it or not, was widespread.
Correct.
And one of the big issues in this particular case is that he has come up with all these methods of extrapolating and saying, okay, we only have a few cases where we have actually proved voter fraud, but those cases are the quote-unquote tip of the iceberg, and they have these extrapolations where they say this many then represent the possibility of this many more. Isn't that what he's arguing?
That's right. So his kind of counter to Professor Menidi was Hans von Spakovsky, and he is a fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mr. von Spakovsky is saying that, yes, this is the tip of the iceberg. He's backing Kobach on this, that the idea that, okay, Kobach may only have, 43 names of people who successfully registered to vote despite being non-citizens. But that is, as you said, the tip of the iceberg, because it's very hard to uncover these cases, and there are likely thousands more. And Kris Kobach started this trial in his opening statements by arguing that the best estimate is upwards of 18,000 non-citizens on Kansas's voter rolls. At this point, we do know that the court would consider that to be a substantial amount, an amount that Kris Kobach could potentially win his case on, but he has to prove it. And as you pointed out, he's relying on statistical projections that the ACLU is going to attack.
And so that's really at the heart of this case, is because he's made these allegations for years, and in fact, backed President Donald Trump in claiming that there were millions of illegal votes that essentially gave Hillary Clinton the popular vote, and even though Donald Trump won the Electoral College vote. So that's kind of floating out there as well. But really at the heart of this, if I could cut through it, is these numbers are out there, these projections are out there, and you have Mr. Kobach arguing that. And what this trial is all about is kind of making him prove it. Is that correct?
He has to prove two things to win his case.
Okay.
He needs to prove that non-citizen registration and voting is widespread. And then the second thing he has to prove is that he can't fix it without his law that imposes a burden on legitimate voters. So to clear that hurdle, he needs to show, we can't just better train DMV workers. We can't just tap into other resources, like let's check the Department of Homeland Security. There's a Department of Homeland Security database called SAVE that is very much a key argument in this case. The ACLU is saying Kansas can do like some other states that they say are using SAVE to just check their voter rolls for non-citizens. Kansas is saying there are logistical reasons they can't do that. So Kobach needs to prove that there are logistical reasons, inadequacies, that any of these other options the ACLU is saying would work just aren't going to cut it. That we have a widespread problem that can only be fixed if you and I cough up our birth certificate.
I think one of the fascinating things about this case, following you on Twitter and others, has been just the circus in the courtroom. I mean, it's coming through to me as a consumer of this information. You're right in the middle of it. But it's coming through to me that there's a great deal of tension building between Federal Judge Julie Robinson and the Kobach team, including Kobach himself, who's representing himself in this trial. Well, there's just a lot of procedural wrangling, and it appears that Kobach and his team are on the losing end of some of those things.
Yes. Where to start? It has been... I never would have expected covering this trial that writing about the trial processes would be so much a part of the story. But when you're watching this, it really is. Mm-hmm. So Kobach and his team have consistently run into hurdles because they apparently failed to submit a good amount of evidence that they want to cite, refer to, show to the court in the course of this trial. But there are procedures for making that available to the other side in advance and then admitting it properly into evidence. And his side is really struggling to follow those procedures. And that has led to, quite frankly, consternation by the judge. She repeatedly has chided Kobach's team for this. And at the end of the third day, she was very clearly fed up. She ended the day pretty abruptly, called one of Kobach's lawyers out of line. Throughout this trial, she's made comments to them such as, this is evidence 101, making clear to them that at this level of litigation and a federal lawsuit, you ought to know these rules. She definitely sounds frustrated.
Well, and so you've been through 1 week of this. We're heading into a second week. What should we expect out of this second week, just big picture?
We're going to learn more about the DMV procedures, how it is that people are accidentally getting registered, because there are situations where it's clear on people's forms they've marked themselves down as a non-citizen, but in some cases maybe it seems they've also signed the oath in the same streamlined process where it says you're a citizen, so these are confusing forms.
So people on Kobach's side might, even though there's a mistake in there, might contend that that is fraud because they have signed the line. You're making the distinction, though, that it could simply just be a mistake.
Yeah, and Kobach's side has conceded that mistakes are accounting for some amount of this. Mm-hmm. However, they still they seem to be arguing through Hans von Spakovsky that this is nevertheless voter fraud, because they're making the argument that any illegal ballot defrauds the public of a legitimate election. And that kind of caught the judge off guard, it seemed, because as she pointed out, the common definition of fraud includes is based on the criminal statutory definition, in which there's an intent.
Mm-hmm.
An intent. You knowingly know that something is illegal and you're purposely trying to slip it past someone.
I was struck too in reading coverage of the trial, Judge Robinson, when the Kobach team would make this argument of disenfranchisement, that any illegal vote disenfranchises a legitimate voter. And apparently that's central to their case. Well, she was responding from the bench, yes, but by that logic, if you have disenfranchised 30,000 voters, as the ACLU claims, isn't that the same thing on a bigger scale? That would seem to suggest that, at least at this point, she's not buying the Kobach team's argument.
I think she was trying to figure out, okay, if you're not coming from the criminal definition of this, that the judge herself said is the common one, then what exactly do you mean by defrauding the public? If then 30,000 people are blocked from voting, for example, wouldn't that then be the same concern of defrauding the public of a legitimate election?
Mm-hmm.
So that was her point.
So this is a really, really important moment, though. This is a really important case because depending on how this comes out, now, clearly there is the prospect for appeals, and this could go on for a while, but depending on how this case comes out, it could really stop these efforts to put these additional requirements in law in various states. It could stop that initiative in its tracks.
That's right.
And that's what the ACLU wants.
That's what the ACLU wants. They're also concerned from their side that if Kobach were to win this case, that it would encourage other states to adopt these proof of citizenship laws. It's worth saying, so yesterday, the court ended with a much anticipated video of Kris Kobach answering questions for about 40 minutes while it's from a deposition where an ACLU lawyer is asking him questions. And in that deposition, we learned that Kobach not only wanted to change federal voter registration law in a way that effectively undermines the current case against him, although he said he wasn't going to pursue that amendment unless he lost his case. Kobach also apparently wanted to talk to Donald Trump about incentivizing changing federal law to prod other states to adopt proof of citizenship laws. So that gives you a sense of the stakes in mm-hmm. this case, right? In that video, what we saw was that the ACLU is pressing Kobach repeatedly, saying, you took this potential amendment to Donald Trump while this case is ongoing, while this court injunction is in place, and these amendments are effectively what we had already told the court would have to happen for you to win your case. Because as federal law is right now, what you're doing is illegal under federal law. And Kobach kept pushing back and saying, no, this was just a contingency plan. I have faith in my case. You know, he's effectively saying what I'm doing is not illegal, but if somehow you manage to convince the federal court system that you're right and I'm wrong, eventually I would pursue these amendments.
So the ACLU's point there was that by going to President Trump with these suggested amendments to federal law, that Kobach was somehow acknowledging that what he knew what he was doing was illegal under federal law and trying
Bingo.
To hedge his bets, right?
Bingo.
Now to our political notebook for the week. From now through the November election, we want to keep you abreast of things happening in the Kansas governor's race and the various contests for congressional seats around the state. And there's been quite a bit of action recently, at least in the governor's race. For starters, Mark Hutton has dropped out of the race for the Republican nomination. Hutton is a former legislator and the founder of a Wichita construction business. He was among the first conservative Republicans in the legislature to challenge former Governor Sam Brownback on the wisdom of his income tax cuts. Hutton is the second Wichita businessman to exit the race, joining Wink Hartman, who dropped out late last month and endorsed Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach for the nomination. The departures leave Kobach, Governor Jeff Collier, former State Senator Jim Barnett, and Insurance Commissioner Ken Selzer as the top contenders for the GOP nomination. Independent candidate for Governor Greg Orman also made news by selecting Kansas State Senator John Dahl as his lieutenant governor running mate. Dahl seems like a good fit geographically. He's from Garden City, while Orman is from Johnson County. And he makes sense politically. He's been a Democrat, Republican, and now independent. Because he changed his party affiliation from Republican to independent, Dahl lost all of his Senate committee assignments. He gave up a seat on the Senate's powerful budget writing committee and vice chairmanships on the education and transportation committees. Still, he says he intends to remain as the Senate's only independent member while campaigning for lieutenant governor.
Please understand, I want to be very clear on this. I'm the senator for the 39th district. Until I'm not the senator of the 39th district, I will do everything that I can to be a strong voice for the 39th district.
On the Democratic side, former legislator and Kansas Agriculture Secretary Josh Swatty spent the last week taking advantage of what you might call his convention bounce. Of the seven contenders for the Democratic nomination who participated in a forum at the state's annual Washington Days celebration, Swatty brought the most energy and most frequently roused the crowd. In the spin room afterwards, he said that was his plan.
This is about energy. I mean, campaigns are taxing, and you have to have it. And you have to be able to convey it in a way that makes voters respond positively.
Following the forum, Kansas City Star columnist Melinda Hennenberger criticized State Senator Laura Kelly's performance. Kelly is thought by many to be the early frontrunner because, among other things, she was recruited into the race by former Governor Kathleen Sebelius. But Hennenberger wrote that her low-key, measured style and the fact that she stumbled in her opening statement contrasted sharply with Swatty's high-energy performance. Some in the crowd who said they favored Kelly going in said they were going to give Swatty a second look, thinking that he might fare better in debates against the flamboyant Kobach, should he capture the GOP nomination. Kelly insists she would do just fine against whoever wins the Republican nomination, whether it be Kobach, Jeff Collier, or someone else, precisely because she's low-key, deliberate, and yes, calm.
Calm, steady, and smart. I think that's what people of Kansas know. They know we're in deep trouble, and they don't want a showboater. They don't want somebody who's looking to get on camera. They're looking for somebody who'll go in that office, roll up her sleeves, and work with others and put this state back on track.
In addition to Kelly and Swatty, contenders for the Democratic nomination for governor include House Minority Leader Jim Ward, former Wichita Mayor Carl Brewer, Olathe Doctor Arden Anderson, Salina Salesman Robert Klingenberg, and Wichita High School student Jack Bergeson. Can't leave him out. In this week's listener questions segment, we're revisiting last week's conversation about the status of a resolution that would add Kansas to the list of states petitioning Congress to call a constitutional convention, a federal constitutional convention. You may recall my conversation with Kansas News Service reporter Maddie Fox. We concluded that the resolution would be a long shot to pass because it required a two-thirds vote. That's 27 of the 40 members in the Senate. Well, we were right, but it was close. The Senate debated and voted on the resolution last week. Supporters like Senate President Susan Weigel, a Wichita Republican, argue that the federal government is out of control, it's too big, and it spends way too much.
I stand here with this bill thinking that I'll retire someday, and I'll probably be able to collect Social Security, but I know for a fact my children, my grandchildren, will not have that benefit. They will not have that security, because the money will be all gone.
But opponents, like Senate Minority Leader Anthony Hensley, a Topeka Democrat, pointed out that every one of the 27 amendments added to the U.S. Constitution has been proposed by Congress and ratified by the states. none has been written by delegates to a constitutional convention because, he said, of concerns that doing it that way could result in wholesale changes to the nation's foundational document.
A convention of the states to amend the Constitution would put unelected, unaccountable delegates in charge with the potential of rewriting our entire Constitution.
Next week, Maddie Fox will be back to help us answer another of your questions about politics, the State House, or a particular issue. So if you have one, by all means, let us know. And you can do that any number of ways, either by posting to our Kansas News Service Facebook page or tweeting it to us. We're at KS News Service, or calling and leaving us a message at 816-235-8025. That's 816-235-8025. I'm Jim McLean, and that's this week's pod. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week for another edition of State House Blend, Kansas.